having heard these things, and I want to react to Dave and to Larry, and no doubt Roger's going to react to me. In looking at these questions, one thing that I want to point out is that when I'm thinking about it, I'm going to emphasize that I'm looking not just, I'm looking more specifically at what I will term reproducibility of the analysis as opposed to reproducibility of the research per se. I'm interested in the question of if everybody agrees that here is the starting raw data, and this is actually not always agreed upon, there is the question of, okay, can we at least from there reproduce how we got to the results that are being reported in a journal or in a claim or somewhere else? That's actually the area that I'm going to focus on. This is distinct from trying to do a set of experiments again. But even within that subfield, which is where we've been fighting a lot of the time, there are still a lot of problems. So that's one of the things that I want to look at. Now, as a bit of context, because this is coming up, one thing that Larry didn't mention, there is actually, at the moment, an Institute of Medicine review committee that is looking at what rules should be in place before omics-based signatures are used to guide therapy in clinical trials. And part of this has to do with reproducibility. What do we need to be able to show we can do again before people can go forward and use these things? And with omics-based stuff, and I'm in bioinformatics, so that's where I spend much of my time, there is an added need, in my view, for attention to reproducibility because, quite frankly, in many cases, if somebody tells me they did a t-test or they look at values, I can plot the values and I can see what the heck's going on. If somebody tells me they've got a signature of 50 or 100 genes that'll predict response, I have no good intuition about what the heck's going on in 50 or 100 dimensions, and quite frankly, I've yet to encounter the doctor who does. So this era of being able to document some of this is pretty useful. Now, there have been four specific questions that we were asked to address pertaining to individual responsibilities and how they are partitioned amongst investigators and journals and agencies and institutions. And so I'm gonna address each of these in turn, and I'm gonna start with the investigators. And my own ideal is that, okay, when you publish a paper, you post on your website, here is the data freeze, and here's all the code that I use to reproduce it, so you can download it, and you click it, and you will get figures, and this is a pipe dream. So I know that one. That's okay. But perhaps the biggest thing that I think that the investigators actually need to be prepared to supply upon request is, can you supply, first off, can you tell us what the raw data was? Can you tell us what the labels were that you applied to these raw data? One thing we have encountered all too frequently is the wonder of treating Excel like a database and then having somebody in your lab delete an entry and having all other entries in that column move up by one row. And this happens, and it can in some cases affect reported results. I have not had any need to invoke any type of malice for this. I'm quite sure that this is happening unintentionally. There are tons of errors out there, and the vast majority of things that we have encountered as errors are simple mistakes where people made them without intent. The problem, however, is that if you've got the data, and if you've got the labels, those can be checked. If you don't have that readily accessible, it often requires a certain amount of detective work to find it, and unless the results are particularly splashy, it's actually fairly unlikely that people are going to spend the time to do that because there's not the reward system in place for it. So I'd love to see data and provenance provided, and even more, in particularly complex scenarios, I'd like to see code provided so that people see how to do it. Many journals ask for verbal or at least written descriptions of what the code or algorithms do. As one who has tried to reconcile verbal descriptions with actual code, I will tell you that I think this is inadequate to the task. I think that you actually need the code. I don't think that there's a shortcut way around that. I think eventually we're going to have to provide it. So that's one of the things I have. It's also something that, as an investigator, there has to be a certain level of responsibility. If somebody comes to you and they probably aren't motivated by vendettas and says, I have a question, and it may involve something that you've published being wrong, the response is, no, you must be wrong. It's, well, okay, I might have made a mistake. It happens. Let me check. And if something's like an off by one error, you say, yeah, there, but for the grace of God, okay, I'll go back and I'll fix it. Now, admittedly, if somebody comes to you and says, I'm curious, how is it that you're reporting genes as significant when the genes you've named aren't on the arrays that you've used? You may have a bit of a more challenging time coming up with an answer to that, but that can happen. So that's the individual's role. Journals. Journals, I think, actually should be asking for the data and code, and actually more than that, something that I think many journals could do that isn't all that hard that they don't right now, is if they're asking for data, they could potentially check to see has it actually been provided. In microarray, there is the Miami standard for minimum information about a microarray experiment. Many journals agree to this, are signatories. That basically means that if you publish a microarray paper in Nature or Science or whatever, you've agreed to deposit this array data at one of two or three centralized repositories. Neil McKenna, about 2.5 years ago, did a survey of 20 journals looking at the rates of deposition in Miami-compliant journals. They're slightly less than 50%. Now, I have this dream that in the journal process that, okay, at part of the proof stage, before it's actually been printed, you can say, oh, by the way, you are required to make the data available, and amongst other things, to state where the data is. In looking at this paper, A, is there a statement of where the data is, and B, okay, we've clicked through and there's nothing there. Is this something that can be checked or possibly even scriptable? I would hope that that's not too bad. Now, another issue that I want to think of from the journal point of view, and I confess I don't know how often this happens, is when questions are raised to journals, particularly if they are provided with some level of supporting evidence, there's an issue of can you treat this seriously? Now, and can you potentially hold the authors to actually provide a stable response? David mentioned this paper on proteomics in The Lancet, which he believes is discredited. It's still there. It's still in The Lancet. It's still cited. I still get questions from people coming to me saying, why aren't we doing this stuff? It's wrong, but it's still there. So there's a question of, should the journals be doing stuff about that? There are some other questions from my own experience. With respect to this Lancet paper, we actually sent a letter to the Lancet pointing out that, in our view, the results were driven by complete confounding of the experimental design. The Lancet responded that, unfortunately, the issues we were raising were too technical for their readership, so they didn't see the need to publish our letter. This then almost rent to the marketing of a medical device, whereupon we published it in Bioinformatics, and the New York Times covered it, at which point the FDA came in and said, would you please stop advertising it this way until we can talk with you? But the fact that they thought it was too technical without necessarily addressing it disturbed me. More recently, as pertains to one of the more recent things at Duke, we pointed out to the Lancet Oncology that there are some problems with one of these validation studies. In particular, they're trying to validate an approach using combination chemotherapy by trying two other combination chemotherapies. Well, first off, there's this mathematical rule for combining probabilities into a combination. Well, there are three combinations used. There are three different rules used. All three rules are incorrect, and the probabilities can get bigger than one. We think this is a problem. Their response was that, unfortunately, the crux of our objection was a statistical issue to which there was no right or wrong answer. And consequently, they did not see a need to publish our letter. So we're a bit curious about whether, but the easiest thing for journals is to ask for data and code. Institutions. Big thing for institutions, as it pertains to reproducibility or whatever, needs to be along the lines that, okay, you've got folks working with you, you want their work to be reproducible, all right. Can you help train them in that? And by that I mean providing tools that make it easier, or for example, if you've got software in place like GenePattern or something else that's not too hard to use, can you say, as you're writing your papers, you should be prepared for the idea that somebody here or somebody at the FDA, if you're going to do medical stuff, may want to do an audit. Can you document it? And the fun thing about reproducibility is that, as a general lesson, if you come to it and you say reproducibility is too hard because I've come to it and I'm writing up the paper and then I've gone back and tried to reproduce it and it's too hard to track down all the data, you're right. It's too hard because you're hitting it at the wrong point in time. The time to be thinking about reproducibility is when you start the project, not at the time of publication. Because at the time of publication, you will have forgotten many of the incredibly intelligent and slick steps you performed to get where you wanted to be. And this is something the institutions can help train with. The institutions also have a job to help investigate some things when questions are raised. And there is an issue that they need to also recognize occasionally that conflicts of interest may obtain. In particular, if the institution has a financial stake in the success of a technology, they may wish to have somebody else look at this. Yes, this has happened recently. Now, another perhaps simple statement is that if people are raising objections and you convene an external review, it would be good if you passed those objections along to the reviewers. In the particular instance I am thinking of, we sent in a list of objections saying, by the way, here's the code showing that the data is wrong. The external reviewers who were invited to look at the data were not told that a report existed showing that the data was wrong, so they took the data at face value and said, we can reach the same conclusions. This was then touted as a validation which allowed the trials to be restarted. That's one reason we don't think it worked. But just passing that forward would be nice. Agencies. Actually, Larry's done a pretty good job here. I'd love to see dollars for reproduction, and if he can find any way that any agency is going to award me $3.7 million for my next application, I'll be delighted to hear it. There is, however, they need to be prepared to provide some dollars for it. That's number one. But they also face a challenge, because to a certain extent, I want them to look at, particularly when clinical trials are involved, the level of reproducibility involved. And this is something that the FDA might do and say, okay, you proposed this signature, and we want you to show that it actually works before we let you treat patients on the basis of this. Now there's a challenge here, which is that many signatures are rather complex, and a few years ago, when presented with a 50-peak proteomic signature, they said, okay, at this point the signature has become sufficiently complex that its assemblage is no longer intuitively obvious, and consequently we are going to invent a new term. We're going to call this an IVD-MIA, an in vitro diagnostic multivariate index assay, which is sort of self-referencing in the sense that they say it is so, because it's not clear how this was derived, it's sufficiently complex that it must be treated, the assemblage, as an independent unit, as a medical device that must be validated. It's not enough to validate that you're measuring gene 1 accurately and gene 2. No, you've got to talk about whether the signature works. And the FDA put this in place and said, because it's a medical device, we have the authority to regulate these things. And I was on a panel with Rich Simon about a month after this came out. I had a discussion with him, and I thought it was great, and he thought it was horrible. And I thought it was great, because it gave the FDA the ability to come in and say, you know, this is probably bad. We're not going to let it go forward. And he thought it was horrible, because he was saying, well, I'm not really sure the FDA knows enough about all these technologies to actually conduct a thorough review. And at the end of that discussion, both of us sort of agreed that to disagree, but we saw some merit in each other's point of view. Now, I agree that the steps are complex, but one thing that I have in mind is particularly for reproducibility, being able to take data and code, click a button, and see that the same results are obtained should not necessarily be that difficult. And actually, I'm willing to have the FDA impose as a requirement on the submitters that you've got to make that task fairly easy for us to do before we can go into more detailed checks. But that's one thing that I think the agencies could do. That's my quick and dirty recitation, so I'm actually now going to sit down and let Roger come in.